Thanks very much, Dave, by the way, for taking the time to make the presentation up and get up early.
Well, no, I've been up since 6:30. I had a 7:30 teleconference as well. Okay, let's get started. Mike O'Connor is biting at the, you know, at the bit. All right, so what I'd like to do is start out by giving you an overview of what Fast Flux hosting is. There's an awful lot of terminology that is associated with this kind of attack. Primarily, what Fast Flux hosting is not specifically an attack, but an evasion technique. There are also many variants of Fast Flux, and it's very important to understand that the example that I'm giving you here is but one of several variants of how Fast Flux is used. A great deal of how Fast Flux is used is not yet known to security practitioners and responders and investigators. The people who are perpetrating Fast Flux are very, very well organized, highly sophisticated in their knowledge and understanding of communications and networking, and they employ techniques and technologies that, quite honestly, as a security practitioner, astonish and impress me. They use encrypted and covert channels. They are adaptive to what are essentially attacks by law enforcement against their networks. They're very, very sophisticated. So part of this whole lesson today is to kind of explain that this is not a simple problem to solve. So the goal of a Fast Flux attack and a Fast Flux hosting incident is to essentially avoid detection and takedown of the websites that phishers and identity thieves and other e-criminals use for whatever illegal purposes they choose. The technique has essentially three components. One component is that in order to sort of sustain a presence of the illegal activities and to be able to constantly pull victims to the illegal sites where they can either capture credentials for an identity theft or sell illegal pharmaceuticals or other bogus products or perpetuate some other scam, is to have that content at many, many sites. The first part is host the content at many sites. Second content part of the attack is to send phishing email with links to the website's domain name. Now we have the domain name in front of potential victims, and we have the content in many locations.
Hold yes.
Joined.
The next part of the attack is to try to stay one step ahead of law enforcement, one step ahead of suspension activities by rapidly changing the locations of the website so that no single website is used long enough to isolate and shut down, or if it is isolated and shut down, other websites can take their place. The best analog that I can think of for describing basic Fast Flux is a streetcar game called Three Card Monty. And I think that many of you may be familiar with this, but essentially the idea of the scam was to lay three cards on a cardboard box on a street corner on a chair. Show potential victims the three cards and say, I'll bet you a dollar you can't follow the ace and you can't identify where the ace is. Now, somebody says, oh, of course I can. You flip the cards over and you constantly move them around so that you're creating a deception of where the card is, and you essentially improve your chances that the victim can't find the card, and as a consequence, he pays you the dollar that he's bet. That's a basic Fast Flux attack. Oh, the animations do work. So essentially, you're moving the cards, rapidly in some sort of non-repetitive fashion. In some cases, there's sleight of hand that removes the ace entirely from the three cards that are present. The second part of this deception, the second part of keeping the scam alive, is actually the part that I find, you know, find most interesting and is most relevant to the DNS community. So in the real world, in the brick and mortar world, the three card Monte scammer runs the scam on a street corner. And what he essentially has is either kids or some other, you know, other members of his scam team who serve as lookouts. And what they do is they watch to see whether a beat cop or any other law enforcement is approaching. If they see law enforcement approaching, they signal the scam artist. The scam artist packs up his game and he moves to a different corner. In the electronic world, and in the case of FastFlux, the scammers alter the domain name system to change the corners. This particular technique is called name server fluxing. When you combine basic and name server fluxing, you end up with what we call double fluxing. I've already identified three variations on the theme, and in fact, all three are used. There are lots of situations where people don't use name server fluxing, but basically stick to fast flux. Double flux is very popular and is a particularly powerful technique that's used by at least one large criminal organization on a very, very massive scale. So we're gonna focus primarily on name server aspects of the fluxing. I'm going to talk about and walk you through in the anatomy of one particular style of attack. This is just an example. This is not necessarily the concrete and only way that you can conduct this attack. Attacks begin by collecting resources for the network that's going to essentially host the FastFlux facilities, the websites, the name servers, and the command and control. The people who actually have those facilities available for lease are called bot herders. What a bot herder is someone who makes a career and a business out of compromising, infecting machines and compromising them, and then taking remote control of them over what's called a command and control channel. So a bot herder essentially gathers up a herd of compromised computers. There are chat channels, IRC channels, where you can go and you can literally barter or broker botnets of any size. And you can get dozens, hundreds, thousands of compromised PCs in the network that you lease, and you'll get command and control of those. And you'll have the ability to upload software to those machines so that you can make them do whatever you want them to do. So bots can be used for a variety of purposes. They can be used for denial of service attacks. They can be used for sending spam. They can be used for fast flux to essentially abet identity theft or to lure people to illegal pharmaceutical sites. Many, many different variants. And the cost of a botnet can be as little as $200, and it can be several thousand dollars. All depends on how big a network you want, how resilient you want the attack to be, and how long you want it to sustain. So now, as the perpetrator of the attack, the criminal in the red hat, I've gone to the criminal in the black hat, and I've built up a network, and now I want to find software that I can use to essentially run my phishing attack. There are another set of criminals who make a career out of writing what are called phishing kits. And phishing kits are relatively straightforward, zipped-up packages of software that contain everything you need to build an illegal website, everything you need to operate a spam relay and drive spam out to potential victims. In some cases, they'll contain mailing lists, or you can actually get spam lists from some other provider. What I want to emphasize in these first three slides is that we're talking about a very, very lucrative and lively underground market for acquisition and sale of illegal goods.
Excellent.
So now we need a domain name. So what, you know, what the criminal in red does is he goes to a registrar and he'll register some domain names. For example, nameserverservicenetwork.tld and bogus website example.tld. Now, via that same registrar, what he'll do is he'll flux the name server records for the zone file in the name that's called nameserverservicenetwork.tld, and he'll use a very, very short time to live in all the name server records that he populates in the registrar's zone. So he now has a time to live of 180 seconds or 3 minutes. At this point, he takes his command and control channels from that he received from the bot herder, and he loads zone files onto selected bots that are going to act as his own domain name servers for bogus website example.tld. Here again, he puts very short times to live. So this second set of A records actually points to the web servers that are running illegal activities. He then uses the botnet command and control channel to upload the bogus websites to the host that he just identified in that zone file, bogus website example.tld. Now he goes and he launches his phishing attack by sending spam to potential victims, and he hopes to lure them to the bogus website. So the victims receive the electronic mail. They have a domain name that in the electronic mail that they will click on if they're not paying attention or if they're lured, and they'll go to one of the websites that is identified in the zone file, bogus website example.tld. And in fact, they'll go to one of them for about 3 minutes. After 3 minutes, steps 5 through 7 are repeated so that while the domain name remains the same, the actual website that is hosting the domain name keeps moving. So it might be a PC on a Comcast broadband access network in San Jose for 3 minutes. It might be a PC on a DSL circuit in Cleveland for another 3 minutes. It might be a PC on some DSL circuit in Paris, you know, for another 3 minutes, and it constantly hops across not only one country, but many countries. In addition, what's happening is that not only is the website changing location, but the name servers are changing location. So as you can see, this is a really formidable problem for someone to actually chase down. Another analog that people typically use is a game called Whack-a-Mole. If you go to an arcade, there is a game where there are holes, and you get a mallet, and you start the game, and these gophers pop up out of the hole, or moles pop up out of the hole, and you smack the mole that's popped up out of the hole, and as soon as you smack that one, a mole pops up in another hole, or maybe two do. And the idea is to try to constantly keep ahead of the moles that, you know, that are popping up. And if you've ever played the game, you have to be unbelievably agile, and you have to have great reflexes and response time in order to win the game. Unfortunately, internet security is not nearly agile enough, and it's not nearly responsive enough, and we don't have sufficient flexibility to stay ahead of fast flux attacks.
Joined.
So I'm going to take a pause and ask if there are any questions, because that is essentially the description of fast flux. And from this point on, what I want to do is talk a little bit about mitigation alternatives and, you know, the tactics that have been used and can be used, and some of the recommendations that FSAC has discussed.
All right, well, Wendy Seltzer, I'd like to get in the queue, if I may.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I missed the very beginning of the presentation, but I wondered whether you talked at all about people who might need to use FastFlux for non-evasive purposes, but merely because they don't have a stable IP address at which to host a domain name and yet wanted to be contactable by other people on the Internet. For example, somebody who wanted to host web services but was behind a DHCP with fast-changing leases, or somebody who was using an anonymizing network but wanted to be able to be contacted by from the outside?
Haven't talked about that yet. So why don't you hold your question, and we'll, you know, we will talk about, you know, talk about that later on.
Thanks.
Mostly what we've talked about so far, Wendy, was essentially just a description of the variations of the attack and kind of a lay of the land of the nature and composition of the criminal infrastructure.
This is Matt Hooker. I'd like to point out something that I think is very important, because I personally have been working to end certain kinds of social crimes that have been protected by FastFlux hosting and that you haven't mentioned. You've mentioned a lot of crimes that are financial crimes and things that don't really strike home as hard as human slavery, sexual trafficking, child pornography. Those are things that also can use FastFlux hosting. I think by mentioning things like that, it brings the importance of addressing this issue quickly to the head. And I think that it's important to also remember that they're not just financial crimes and phishing. There are serious crimes involving slavery, trafficking, and child pornography that use FastFlux networks. And that's what law enforcement believes. And we need to provide law enforcement with the better way to actually locate the computers. So we need to make some changes as soon as possible.
I absolutely agree with you. I'm fairly certain that the FastFlux advisory actually mentions child pornography. It does not mention human slavery. It would be something I talk to you a little bit more about if you can, especially if you know of incidents where FastFlux has been associated with those, you know, truly despicable kinds of crimes. I don't like to write advisories with a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, but I do like to write them with a lot of accuracy. If you have some incidents that you could, point me to, I'd like to read them, and I'd be more than happy to amplify what's already in the advisory by raising this as yet another set of threats.
I have law enforcement contacts who have information that I can try to direct them to you.
That'd be great. Thanks. Either Nick or I will put my email up at the end just to make certain that you can get in touch with me. But thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's look at that. At the three traditional ways that people have looked at trying to solve the problem that FastFlux poses. The first is, and sort of obvious, is that whack-a-mole, shut down all the bots in the botnet that host FastFlux. The second, and I'm going to go through these in detail in a moment. The second is to try to shut down the FastFlux hosts themselves as we encounter them. And the third is to try to remove the domains that are used in FastFlux hosting from the servers. Now, this is sort of not an exclusive presentation in terms of what you do, but inclusive. All these can play a part in reducing the FastFlux threat. So no one of them is going to actually stop it. For example, you can't just rely on removing domains used in FastFlux hosting from the service, because FastFlux hosters can find other alternatives to do that. And they can use IP addresses as a very rude example. And while many of us would say, oh, well, that's easy to detect, figures show that even when IP addresses are embedded in URLs, people are silly enough to click on them. So that's not a sufficient solution. Anyway, let's look at all three of these at a little bit more careful level and look at some of the pros and cons of trying to use each of these methods. So shutting down the bots. Shutting down the box is a very, very challenging and daunting problem because of the sheer scale of the numbers of infected computers on the net today. It's also daunting because the current mitigation techniques rely on anti-malware on desktops and at security gateways in businesses or run by ISPs. Honestly, anti-malware is reactive. The FastFlux people are very, very sophisticated. They adapt the software that they use, especially the bot herders, adapt the software they use to infect and populate compromised machines. They engage in as much evasion in writing polymorphic viruses and polymorphic malicious software as they do in developing FastFlux networks. So signature-based antivirus may catch some of this, but if you go and you look at some of the statistics about the real ability for some of the even most popular anti-malware products to detect things like keyloggers, you'll find that the efficacy rates are down in the 40 to 70%, and that's not going to cut it. So, that's only one way to try to eliminate the problem. The other thing is that we tried very hard to provide education and awareness. I don't think there is anything that is discussed more in the world than spam and phishing. Yet, spam and phishing just grows and grows and grows, and the amount of criminal activity that's enabled by phishing is simply increasing at an exponential rate. So those two combined are not coming close to stemming the tide. Some of the other techniques that people are experimenting with but have not gained traction are things like process and executable whitelisting. What this is basically educating and providing software solutions that simply say, if your executable, if your software, if your program, if your data link library is not listed in, as an appropriate piece of software, you can't run it on this PC. Some of these packages are available. Some are freeware. Some are commercialware. It's not clear yet how successful people are when using them, because there's an awful lot of the tendency to say, well, I'll just turn it off, or I'll turn it off every time somebody says, do you really want to run this? So there is a learning curve there as well. Another technique that is growing in the enterprise, and I would sincerely hope that at some point it would become something that would be popular among public internet services, is what are called network access or admission controls. What this basically does is allow a network administrator to force a PC to undergo a compliance check before it acquires an IP address and is allowed to send traffic to the internet. The compliance check can contain many things. It could contain checks to see if antivirus software is running. Checks to see when a scan had last been performed. It could also include automated scans, remote automated scans. It could include checks of registries, checks to see what files and permissions are available on the machine. And essentially, it is almost like a customs and immigration control point for a network. If the PC doesn't get a clean bill of health, it can't get on the network. This is one of those, you say, wow, but I will tell you that the organizations that I've worked with and that I've gone and visited that are running Cisco's NAC, Network Access Control, have far fewer problems than networks that are just basically out there and running whatever people want. So, we all say, wow, and, don't take away my self-administration, but then we all whine like stuck pigs when we get attacked, or when our accounts are compromised, or when we open up our checking account and find that there's nothing left. So, we can't have it both ways. The last thing that is also appearing is more and more research and experimentation in the inclusion of bot detection activities in these unified threat management security appliances. So a unified threat management device is basically a firewall that also contains a lot of intrusion detection capabilities, and intrusion detection capabilities that are not only network-related but also very application-specific. So it might be able to actually look at IRC channels, look at encrypted traffic, and see if that encrypted traffic possibly forms a pattern that is indicative or signature of bot activity, and then it would block that PC from continuing to communicate with the net. These are all, you know, very,
man
very
in the middle in my internet connection.
Well, it's not necessarily a man in the middle, because in some of these cases, there's no attempt to actually decrypt the traffic. It's just recognizing the signature hash of the particular packet that are coming across and saying, you know, I've seen this series of encrypted packets before. It looks just like this phishing attack, and so we're going to block it. Yeah, and as I said, this is all very, very much in the formulative and experimental stages. Obviously, security vendors are keen to have a solution for this because it would be a huge moneymaker. But these are not widely available, nor are they widely practiced. Of the three, the only one that is getting any serious traction is the network ignition control in private networks. So shutting down the bots is, you know, is one way to approach this. It's not as successful as we might hope. Okay. Look back. So what about shutting down the FastFlux hosts? Shutting down FastFlux hosts involves identifying the host, finding out who owns the host, contacting the host administrator, convincing the host administrator that he has a problem, convincing the host administrator that he ought to take the machine offline or suspend the domain so that the activity ceases. Okay. Unfortunately, as I say in ARMS, the shutdown process operates at a real-world pace. In some cases, court orders are required. If you go to a hosting site, for example, you can't just walk in and say, you know, DuPont.com is sending phishing attacks. Please take, you know, suspend DuPont.com. That's not going to happen, right? You know, you might have a better chance of suspending MumblyPeg.com if it's running, as Wendy said, on a rapidly changing short expiring DHCP lease behind a dynamic DNS. But there are also people who make a living out of running what are called bulletproof hosting sites. What they essentially do is drag their feet and don't cooperate with law enforcement, or they operate outside jurisdictions, and they provide safe harbors. Then you have to go to a higher level than just the administrator. You have to go to the registrar. You have to go to the registry. You have to go with a very significant and compelling case to take the name out of the zone. This is exactly what FastFlux hopes to have happen. It wants to slow down the pace of response, because every minute that the sites remain up is a minute that they can lure another victim and collect some sort of reward, or continue to conduct the despicable activities that Matt mentioned before. So one of the problems that happens is that, the FastFlux hosts remain operational well beyond the average illegal site lifetime of approximately 4 days. What additional measures could we implement at this level? Some of the things that the anti-phishing working group is working on in the Internet Policy Forum that I participate in are recommendations for accelerating domain name suspension processes. Another possibility is to increase information sharing among responders, certs, and LEAs so that responders are known to the law enforcement agents, are known to the courts, they're acknowledged as experts, acknowledged as good guys, and they become literally accredited and can participate or provide some sort of expedited information transfer that helps suspend names in a more rapid manner. So Nick said there are two questions.
Hi, this is Evan Leibovich. I've got a question wondering if it's possible to do something that could be done on an advisory level as opposed to blocking things out. I mean, I've worked with things such as ORBS and other blacklist systems that are advisory. You have your email system that consults with a database of known spammers and known bad guys. Even though the courts have a problem shutting them down, at least it's possible to build up a database of hosts that have hosted bad sites. Is it not possible to rely more on this kind of thing?
Well, it's Evan, right?
Yes.
So you know, Spam House and McAfee and dozens of other people have spam relay block lists, have website block lists, firewall vendors, web proxy vendors provide feeds from companies like WebBlocker that identify these lists. They've been around for, I would say, let's see, I'm trying to remember the first time I actually used one was at least 7 years ago. All I can tell you is that for every name that they can add, there are probably a dozen more that are out there that they can't add fast enough. What the block lists do, at least for the people who are compliant with constantly maintaining that update, is close the window a bit. But relying on them, really hasn't proven to be effective enough to say that that's enough to do, quite honestly.
Dave, this is Mike O'Connor.
Yeah.
What about turning it around? What about saying that the list, rather than being a block list, which suffers all of the ills that you've described, is instead an ad list that says you get permission to FastFlux? So if you're Google or Yahoo or somebody that needs to move IP addresses a lot for load balancing or whatever, sure, you've got your name on the list, and if I'm an ISP and I see FastFlux behavior from Google and Yahoo, I let that through. But if I get bogus domain.tld exhibiting FastFlux behavior in my infrastructure, I stop it. Is that feasible?
Well, you're touching on I think two related but separate topics. One is either a whitelist or reputation-based service that operates on a domain level, right?
I'm thinking not so much a reputation as a permission. And I'm thinking that perhaps ICANN or some designated neutral party commercial interest actually maintains this, and then I, as an ISP, subscribe to it, not permission-based, or not reputation-based, but permission-based.
So if it's permission-based, you're saying that are we talking about permission-based use of FastFlux or permission-based use of I'm confused. What are we permitting? Are we permitting?
Yeah, we're permitting FastFlux. We're saying.
Yeah. Well, let's set that aside for a second because, again, I think that's something we're going to talk about when we talk about the registry and registrar level. And yes, I mean there's certainly something that registrars and registries can do in order to acknowledge that that there are legitimate practices, and that the notion that you have one policy enforcement that says nobody's allowed to have time to live less than 7 hours probably can't accommodate everyone's needs. So I'm going to address that topic. But I want to talk a little bit about the problem of trying to do reputation-based whitelisting or whitelisting in general. And it's an activity that we're seeing more of as Fast Flux is becoming something that has attracted more public attention than the criminals would like. So I'm going to depart just a second from the presentation. I'm going to go back and say, imagine if what I'm doing with Fast Flux or what I'm doing with hosting phishing is I'm now going to someone who is not a registry or who is not a registrar, but what I'm doing is I'm leasing subdomains outside under his domain. So the domain is ihostscammers.tld, and what I do is I go and I get from this host, dupont.ihostscammers.tld, icann.ihostscammers.tld, Citibank.ihostscammers.tld. And now I run my attacks at that third level of the domain name system. Do I whitelist how can I blacklist or blocklist ihostscammers.tld if what they can do is demonstrate that they also have several hundred legitimate users? People who are operating businesses. In fact, this is one of the problems of something like a dynamic DNS. We've got lots of perfectly legitimate people who are out there running perfectly legitimate websites, and they're all underneath my domain. So, we have to be very careful how hard we press and the directions that we press, because this is more or less a scenario where we may have a roach-infested kitchen. And the solution to eliminating the roaches from the kitchen isn't to turn on the lights and make them scatter to other rooms in the house.
I'm not sure I tracked the analogy, but I guess the thing I'm thinking is that legitimate fast flux is a fairly unusual activity. It's not thousands.
Right, and I'm going to talk about that. I promise. I promise Wendy, and I promise you.
Okay. And all I'm saying is that rather than all I'm trying to do is reverse the sign on the intervention from blacklist to whitelist.
I think that I'm talking more about blacklisting and whitelisting domains in particular, not about blacklisting or suspending domains based on their zone content. Okay, yeah. you're talking about suspension. Versus accommodation of shorter TTLs. And I'm going to talk about that, I think, in either the next one or two slides. So at this point, what I'm really talking about is, as we detect that a domain name is affiliated with illegal activities, how do we suspend that domain name? Irrespective of whether it is operating a fast flux or not, the problems end up being the same for law enforcement and responders. Fast Flux simply makes it very hard.
Yeah, see, I guess I would say don't even worry about suspending the domain because that takes forever. Just don't pass it across your router. I mean, if I'm an ISP and I've got a giant router, I can certainly insert a table that says, here's the list of approved Fast Flux domain, subdomain, triple subdomain, doesn't matter, and nothing else traverses the router if it's got a TTL of 180.
So what you're suggesting is that there is that when I go to when a client tries to access a name in a domain name table, one of the things that you would expect the ISP to do is to actually look at the TTL of the record and then determine whether or not it's supposed to allow or block traffic to this domain based on whether it's an acceptable short TTL or not acceptable short TTL?
No, I think I'd probably do it not at that level, because I'd generate a boatload of traffic if I did that, because I'd be looking that table up all the time. I think instead what I would do is I would sit there and scan the behavior of my network periodically, and if I saw fast flux happening, not based on client requests, but just watching the router. If I saw fast flux happening, I'd go, huh, I wonder if that's fast flux that's on the whitelist. And I'd go...
Well, it's, I guess the you'd have to find particular spots in the, you know, there's a dimension here that I think you're overlooking, and that is that users are accessing these bogus links from
links.
Hundreds of thousands of point access points in the internet, and there's no one single router that they're going through that can actually check to make some determination that this is a fast flux or not.
No, I agree, but I think the collaboration across ISPs, registries, and registrars could provide that capability. And I think
it might. I think that no one has figured out exactly how to do that yet, but that's certainly a possibility. I mean, yeah, some sort of collaboration that would allow you to identify a signature of what a fast flux would look like is certainly possible. My personal feeling is that signature-based intrusion prevention is not going to solve this, because these people are way smarter, and as soon as they see that that you understand what their activity is, they'll simply change the way their activity is sufficiently so that they thwart your countermeasure.
Well, but I think the signature isn't the traffic. I think the signature is the speed with which the IP address changes, and that's not something they can vary.
Well,
I think the gentleman is right, but your implementation is wrong. This is Matt Hooker speaking, and I think that on page 11 of the GNSO issues report on fast flux, the 25th March report, I can list 5 different ways that we could solve this problem, and I suggest implementing all 5 at the registry operator and registrar level, and have not a whitelist, but a box that they check saying certain sites who need fast flux because they have heavy traffic and who have only legal content, like Google and Yahoo, they're allowed to do this, and everyone else is not by default. I think that's the proper implementation.
That sounds great. That's really where I was headed. Thanks.
That's exactly what could solve the problem, I think.
Cool.
Whoa.
I think that it won't be quite as trivial as that. However, we'll talk about that. Why don't I move to the next set of slides, because I think we're going to talk about that looks like the hot topic, so let's try to get through some of the other things. So what about removing domains used in fast fluxing from the service? We've already gone through a lot of this because I've talked about some domains are very easy to delete, fairly obscure strings, things that domains that are clearly registered with gross whois inaccuracies. There are registrars that have almost 80% of their sponsored registrations have whois inaccuracies, and a disproportionate number of those are actually affiliated with phishing sites, and we're getting more and more statistics out of the APWG and McAfee and some other people who are studying this and discovering that there's a very, very big correlation here, and there are some clear bad actors on the outskirts of the registrar community that we ought to take a little bit more careful look at, and ICANN compliance is doing that. So we're trying that. Other domains are hard to take down. I already mentioned this. Bulletproof hosts where safe harbor conditions exist. There are countries that could care less or make it extremely difficult for anyone other than their own law enforcement and their own certs to deal with these things. The simple thing that I think a lot of you are concerned about, and justifiably so, is that if you take overly simplistic detection methods, you may end up with a lot of false positives. You may be blocking people who have a legitimate right to do this. Okay. Some of the other things that we can do are, practicing having authenticating contacts before you allow network name server record changes. I actually think this is part of due diligence in doing something like this. The current process is that you make a change through your typically, you make a change to a name server record through your domain name registration portal, and you get a notice by email saying you changed the record. I think it would be nice if what we got was an email saying as technical administrator of this domain, you must click on this link and confirm that you made this name server change before we put it into place. Okay. Some of the other things that were suggested possibly are in the GNSO list, I confess I haven't read that. Rate limit name server record changes. Essentially say, if you're going to make a change, yeah, sure you can make a change for 3 minutes, but you can't make another one for 30. If you make another one for 30, you can't make another one for 4 hours. This is just speculative. None of these things have been tested in practice to see whether they, whether they work or not. Delete and block automated name server record changes. This is a countermeasure that essentially acts as intrusion detection, watching for patterns that suggest that this is automation and blocking it. Enforcing a global or registry specific minimum TTL. There are registrars who actually do this right now. You can go to GoDaddy and you can try to set your TTL to less than 30 minutes, but they won't let you do so. Now, they probably, for clients who do demonstrate trust, have a whitelist or exception handling for registrants with legitimate uses. And I think what we've been talking about is exactly that point. Whitelisting and exception handling for legitimate uses is certainly one of the things that we could consider to make certain that the good fast flux doesn't get thrown out with the bad. The problem is going to be identifying who is good and who is bad. And just on this call, we've talked about two sets of people who represent entirely different trust models and have very, very different motives for why they want to be able to fast flux. So you have the people who run Akamai networks at the high end of the spectrum, like a Google or an Amazon or some other large merchant with multi-country presence, multi-circuits, trying to shift shift traffic, trying to arbitrate whatever resources they use for maximum profit. You also have the people that Wendy mentioned who are sitting there with these short expiring leases who want to run anonymity environments or web servers. So how do you distinguish the ones that Wendy's talking about who are good actors from the people who are doing human slavery or child pornography? Even if you put this clause in, it is not going to be simple to implement. Oh, by the way, Mike, you are not disruptive at all. I love comments like this. So.
By the way, you mentioned four of the five suggested changes on that March 25th GNSO report, the fifth being limiting the number of name servers that can be defined for a given domain.
Limiting the number of name servers you can bind for a domain.
That can be defined for a given domain.
By name or by address?
No, by name. You also by address, but that's another point.
I understand that. It's just that there's lots of permutations, and what that does is it actually lowers the window a bit, and I think that's probably a good practice. It's probably not sufficient because if you allow, let's say, 10 name server records, and you only allow 10 address changes, permutationally, that's much, much easier than if you allow unlimited. I don't know in practice how one would do that if one's not running the domain, but it's worth it's worth taking a look at. Sure. I think another thing that is probably very important, just simply from the perspective of improving takedown, is to get people to write better universal terms of service agreements, so that you can point to a clause that says, hey, you know what? You're not allowed to use my facilities for criminal activities. And I found you doing it, and you're in violation or breach of this clause of your universal term of service, and I don't care what you say, I'm taking you down. And that should be the right of the provider. And I think that providers ought to include this and ought to flex that right if they feel that it's necessary. And Mike says, we already do. And some people do and some people don't, Mike, right? One of the things that we're doing at the APWG is we've got a redirection page that we've written that we would encourage ISPs and other, you know, other parties who do domain resolution to use, and even private enterprises to use in local local environments. But essentially says, when we find a domain that is a bad domain, we take that domain and we resolve it to a page provided by the APWG that says the name you just attempted to go to was a phishing page. The phishing page, you came here and they were trying to do one of several illicit activities. Here's how you can avoid being, and this time you were lucky because you went to a page that's now shut down. So that it doesn't happen to you again in the future, here are the lessons you can learn. So that education page is essentially a grandchild of a page that's had some success in Brazil. CERT Brazil had begun this by putting up some anti-phishing education and then started with this redirect page, and they found it to be quite effective. How effective? Effective enough that some people learn. You never teach everyone everything, so if you can teach some people some things, it's worthwhile. So other things that we want to talk about, because the next slide I think is the last slide. Wendy, did we cover what you had wanted to discuss?
I threw into the chat one more reason that people might legitimately want to use FastFlux, and that's those trying to use proxy networks to evade censoring regimes, that using the DNS to find the locations of their proxies before the regime can get there to shut them down. They might need to do an awful lot of hopping around. They might need to do that by automated means to make the system function. They're already battling with tremendous power on the other side, and I would be concerned about restrictions that would make it harder for them to get full unfettered access to the internet.
So it's curious that you call that a legitimate use, because you're taking the perspective of the people who are evading the censorship that it's legitimate, whereas the people who are trying to impose the censorship would say that it's not legitimate.
Agreed. And I don't think we should be choosing in our policymaking between those two.
I think you raise a very, very interesting social point there, because I don't know how you actually can make the judgment in a change as to whether or not the change has some censorship implication or not. I think that's a very, very interesting topic, and if you're going to be in Paris, we ought to talk about it.
I'd look forward to it. Thanks.
Nick says, aren't you able to host material outside the censoring regime? Well, the problem, Nick, is that in the situations that Wendy's talking about, you've got a population of people who don't want to be censored. And what they do is they are trying to run ways to tunnel through censoring firewall or filtering firewalls or some other application level content filtering applications that the government or some censoring agency is running. Obviously, the government wants to triangulate those in the same way that Nazis tried to triangulate radios in French and other undergrounds ran in World War II, and they want to take them down. So one of the things that you could do in the case of these proxies is you could constantly change where they are, because you can run them on any on PCs. You could basically emulate or even use bot software.
University.
Yeah. And And so it's a it's a very, very interesting subject. And I think it would be very, very very, very enlightening to, you know, to raise this in certain meetings that I can and see how various people from various countries react. Okay, anything else? Yeah, I guess, and the other thing, Wendy, is, I mean, this is, I think Michael points out that, yeah, how do you tell whether or not the fast flux is being used to, keep child pornography and slave and human slave trafficking alive, or whether it's allowing people to get outside of restricted freedom of press? I mean, I think that those are really, really hard issues that we haven't solved, in many, many other ways. In the brick and mortar world, it's going to be really, really interesting to see how we can, address them in the virtual world.
I absolutely agree that there are hard problems. I would just tend to suggest not loading into the network solutions that cause more problems or solve partial problems by causing other problems. So I'm glad to hear that there will be opportunities to consider it.
I would just like to comment on that. It's Matt Hooker again, that anonymity is not necessarily guaranteed when you publish something. And
it is by the First Amendment.
Not anonymity. Your right to speak is guaranteed, but not anonymity.
Your right to speak anonymously is guaranteed.
I disagree. Your right to say what you want is guaranteed, but not anonymously, because when you...
The Supreme Court has disagreed.
Well, whatever. I'm just saying that we have a new publishing medium that is one of the things the Internet is, and it's not necessarily a guarantee that you can get by anonymously if you own your own server or if you have a domain name. You can publish anonymously on thousands of websites. That's quite easy to do. You can blog anonymously. So there is still a way to do something to say what you want anonymously. But if you're going to own a domain name, you might not have that anonymity guaranteed. That's my point. And I think it's a good one. I don't think that we should allow anonymity when people have their own domain name. But there's thousands of places to say things anonymously on the web. Thousands. Maybe millions.
Well, we're a little bit off. I mean, I'm delighted to make this or to continue this conversation. But for those people who actually want to wrap this up and log off, I'll stay on and chat for a little bit longer as well. But we're closing on an hour long presentation. I know some people probably are going to need a bio break shortly. Others may want to go to sleep. So let's just wrap up. So one of the things that I've been talking about is we can do this, we can do that. I think that it's real important for people to understand that what's going on here is way more than FSAC, way more than ICANN, and that what FSAC's role has been thus far and what FSAC's role is always is to study matters brought before it by the board or by the community, publish findings, share information with other communities that have similar similar interests and concerns about issues relating to security and stability, and make recommendations to the ICANN board and community. What ICANN can do is basically continue to work with registries and registrars, and I'll try to figure out, as we've mentioned, some policies and either common and best practices that actually allow us to damp down the growth of double flux while we figure out ways to further contain or possibly eliminate it. I think the constituencies and communities, just by ALAC being as interested and involved as this group is on the issue, is a very, very positive thing, having the sort of education and outreach, not only at an ICANN meeting, but to ISPs and other Internet users and businesses is very important. I think one of the roles that ALAC ought to be able to bring to ICANN is, or the ICANN community is, saying to ISPs, look, this is really a serious problem, and this is something that we really want you to start to pay more attention to, And your role at the edge of the network is to help us try to, you know, limit or damp down the number of, you know, of machines that are getting connected through your, you know, through your service. It's not your role to clean them all up, but it certainly might be something in your best interest to not be constantly the point of ridicule that, you know, that most of the world, you know, throws at you when they see that, you know, of the 100,000 bots identified, 45% are from a particular cable company. So that's, that's pretty much the end of it, I believe. These are the findings that we mentioned. We did not specifically say that you have to enforce a TTL of greater than 30 minutes. We
Steve
said that
balance.
In environment where that has been enforced, or things like blocking and rate limiting have been enforced, registrars have reported they've had fewer incidences of fast flux reported to them. So I think that there's a lot still yet to be learned about fast flux. And double flux. There's a lot that we can consider in terms of trying to improve our response times. I think we're pretty much in a green field of what kind of solutions would be best. Any other questions?
This has been, really great, Dave. Thanks very much for taking the time, and I'm glad that so many people dialed in and were interested in the subject and asked so many thought-provoking questions.
Yeah, Cheryl here, Dave. I think it's been an excellent presentation. I certainly have thoroughly enjoyed it, and I believe I think the discussion and the interchange is a great thing to be able to facilitate. I really want to thank you most sincerely for this, and trust that this will not be the last of these types of events where the important work that FSAC does can be shared in this type of format with an interested audience from the at-large community.
I'm more than happy. If there are other topics that that you feel would, ALAC would benefit from some sort of briefing like this, I think, Nick and I can arrange to do this sort of thing on a more regular basis. It's not an imposition. This is my job. And part of, my personal feeling is that the better educated the entire community is, the better on we are to try to get rid of some of this abuse, because it's this is not the internet that I wanted to help build in 1983.
fair enough, and I must say, Australia's ALS, the Internet Society of Australia, has been approaching it this year with our decision and policy makers, including government, in a cyber savvy awareness exercise, and I regret not having had you on the programs we were running earlier in the year. So beware. Now your talents are obvious.
Cheryl, that's a good name. are you volunteering him, are you?
That's our executive director, Holly Raish, obviously thinking that that's a good idea too. Thank you, David.
Yes, indeed.
It has been brilliant. And I think also thanks to everybody who's dialed in and connected through Adobe Connect at whatever time of day your time zone makes it.
Yes, thanks very much for everyone and their interest. It's a pleasure to arrange
Thank
things.
You.
So well attended.
Okay, guys, I'm signing off.
Left.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.